Hey, Anna, you know we've got the North Star, also known as Polaris, visible in the northern sky anywhere around the Cincinnati area, right?
Of course.
And it guides us, tells us where north is, and then we can know where south is, and east and west are, and all that.
Of course.
Well, in the southern hemisphere, there is no equivalent. There is no South Star.
Oh.
I know. It's very difficult to find your way. It's so easy in the northern hemisphere. All you have to do is look for that North Star, and you can guide your way. But in the southern hemisphere...
Forget Google Maps OnStar. No. Just use the North Star. Well, that's what I mean, I do anyway.
Yeah, that's the same here. I mean, I figure everybody does that. I mean,
absolutely.
You go outside, you do your orientation, you're like, yep, Big Dipper, Little Dipper, Polaris. Okay, now
totally.
I'm set.
I go this way.
Yeah. So you'll be really in the dark then if you go to the southern hemisphere.
No pun intended.
Because there will be no South Star.
Oh, man.
And so it's just this random chance that we have a star above our North Pole. So this star, Polaris, is 400 light years away, but it just happens to be oriented above our North Pole. Whereas in the southern hemisphere, there is no real bright star.
Come on, universe. Throw us a bone.
I know. So Jeez. It made it very difficult for all the explorers going down to the southern hemisphere.
Uh-oh.
So when you go down south, the North Star gets lower and lower and lower in the sky. So when you're partying at South Beach in Miami, like
obviously,
you usually do.
As one does.
The North Star is going to be lower in the sky, but then you get below the equator, no North Star.
Is that how we lost Magellan?
That is actually how we lost a lot of Portuguese sailors.
They
started going south, and they're like, uh-oh, I'm turning back.
Oh, wait, am I turning back? I can't tell.
Magellan's like, nah, I'm going. I'm good.
Wish they would have just Google mapped it.
Well,
wait,
that would have been
easier. That's right.
This is 400 years before Google Maps.
My bad.
Well, from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer with his head in the stars, and I keep his feet on the ground. On this episode, we're joined by Cincinnati native Amanda Bauer, an astronomer now working with the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. Okay, so I go to the south. I'm going to be in trouble because I obviously use the stars for navigation.
I know. The stars are totally different if you go north and south.
Mm. Well, like at all. But then at different times of the year... They never sync up. I mean,
they don't. So this is how it works. So where we are so if you travel east or west, the stars and constellations are going to be pretty much the same. So you'll see Orion in the same place, and Gemini and Taurus and all those will be in the same place. But you go north and things start shifting. So the northern sky like kind of gets up higher and higher and higher. And if you're on the North Pole, if you're standing there in the North Pole, the North Star will be straight overhead, and all the stars will seem to make this circle around there. No stars will rise, no stars will set. They'll just circle around endlessly. And so that's why you get these times in the summer where the sun will just circle endlessly and never set.
Oh.
But then if
that sounds terrifying.
Well, I know. Think about
it. Like it never sets. It just like, it's like, I'm good.
6 months.
That's weird.
So if you kind of like chart it out, you'll see the sun will kind of spiral up. And then we'll spiral back down again.
But not all the way down.
Well, then it goes all the way down for 6 months of darkness. I know. So when you travel north and south, things get much more different than we're used to. But the good news. So if you want to see more stars, you want to see new stars you've never seen before, go south. So the farthest.
Because I have not seen them before.
Exactly. Because our horizon is blocking the view to some of these stars in the southern sky. So it's like you're walking down the globe. And
because the Earth is round.
You got it. So
yes.
We tried to demonstrate this with a Stargazers episode, but you know Stargazers and graphics. You know, I mean, their graphics are...
You're telling me those flying hoverboards couldn't convey this.
So what we did was I said, guys, I have this great idea. Because I have this metaphor. It's like you're walking down the globe. So we pretended that I walked down the Earth to go to Florida, to Miami. And seeing me walk in place in a green screen was pretty funny.
Is that footage somewhere.
And the footage is out there.
Really enjoy that. And we can put it on our Facebook page.
And so not only, so I had to pretend like I'm walking down the globe, but I'm just
Did
moving.
You like have your arms
Yeah, I'm,
going?
I'm wiggling my arms back and forth. And then they moved the globe underneath me. And somehow it made the cut. They said, oh, that's good enough. I mean, it what? Did not look good.
Oh my
it
God, where is this episode? I need to
look
see it.
Look on the internet.
I will look on the internet. I'll post it on our Facebook.
So you don't actually walk down the globe. You fly, you know, or however you go.
Thanks for that clarification.
But you're going down this curve. And so right. when you go south, then you can see all these stars that you can't see from the Cincinnati area. So there's, you know, the main constellation, the southern sky, is the Southern Cross. These four stars, they're very close together and have this cross shape. They're just so dynamic. And
are they really just a random cluster of stars that someone called the Southern Cross?
Exactly.
Some Crosby, Stills, and Nash band Probably. Was like, Southern Cross, there it is.
There it is.
So what other ones can I see? Well, now I want to why am I missing out on constellations?
Exactly.
I want to see them all.
Exactly. That's what we're missing out on, all this stuff. So there's, the Southern Cross, we have Alpha Centauri. That's our mm-hmm. closest star to the sun. So we can't see that from Cincinnati. You have to be down at least in South Florida or farther south in the tropics to be able to see it.
I'd be willing to maybe the show, because I know we have a huge budget.
Yeah.
They fly me, they make me go down there.
Yep.
Force me to go down to the tropics.
Yep.
Pick a city, pick an island.
I'll do
the research.
In December. Or February,
fine.
Something like that.
Anytime, really, but yeah.
And
check it out.
So that is one of the things that people do, is they travel to other places on the globe to be able to see these stars. And so this is why we have so many observatories in the Southern Hemisphere. We've got observatories in Australia, in Chile, in South Africa, because they can see stars that we can't see in Cincinnati.
And the weather is nicer.
The weather is really. Nicer.
And the seasons are flip-flop. Did you know that?
They are. That's right. I know. We're getting into spring here, and then they're going to be into fall. There and
that's so weird.
Yeah,
like it just seems like it would just well, it's weird. It seems like when we're above something, do you know what I mean? Like it should be the same,
right?
It's weird that it's like parallel. What is it? Latitude, not longitude, or whatever.
Yeah, it's the latitude is what the big difference is. So if you're on longitude, it doesn't matter so much. It's the latitude that. Yeah, and it's all about how much sunlight you get at different angles. And so one of the weird things is that Cincinnati was a good spot to have an observatory back in the day, back in the 1800s, because we were far south.
Oh my gosh!
Can you believe that?
It's weird to think about, even though our weather is not conducive.
No, but we had some motivated people that wanted to buy a telescope. But
heck yeah.
But all the observatories before ours, all of them were in England, which is like latitude in the 50s.
Yeah.
And Russia and Paris, and so we were like the southernmost spot, even though we're only at 39 degrees north. So, but you set up observatories at different parts of the globe, then you can see the entire sky.
And I wonder, is that why, like, Hawaii's got a lot of telescopes? They have, like, nice weather, and you can, like, view through them, and it's not, like, cold and gross and weird like it is here, like, a good amount of the time.
Yeah, and it helps to have spots where you're above, higher up elevation, so you can be above
sense.
The clouds atop times. And so, yeah, Mauna Kea up in the Big Island of Hawaii, I went to visit there last year, mm-hmm. and just it's such a gorgeous spot that you're, like, on the surface of the moon up there. Just the landscape is so surreal, and then you have these gigantic telescopes that are just operating nonstop, checking out stuff. It's like, it's a really cool place to go.
Meanwhile, you're like, in Cincinnati, one time we had two clear nights in a row where we got to view.
Exactly.
It's just like such bad, you do lament sometimes that it's bad weather here.
I've heard
you say it before. Like,
I know.
Oh, this is never
I know.
Like,
whose bright idea was it to build an observatory in Cincinnati? That's what I always say.
That's a good question.
But we're so glad they did.
Our founder, incidentally, was the one.
I know. I'd be out of work. We really enjoy talking with folks from our base here in Cincinnati who are working in astronomy, and today we get to spend some time with Amanda Bauer, a graduate of the University of Cincinnati, and now the head of education and public outreach for the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope based in Tucson. However, today Amanda is on site in Chile, so we're excited to welcome her to Looking Up. Well, Amanda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you are calling us from Chile. What is going on in Chile right now?
Well, I am working with a team that's building a pretty massive telescope on one of the peaks in the Andes. It's called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, and this is my very first visit down here to see the construction site, so I'm pretty excited.
Oh, so it's just getting, they've broken ground and all that?
Yeah, they broke ground about 4 years ago, and so they've got the base facility is being constructed in a small town called La Serena. Up on top of a mountain called Serra Pachón is where the telescope structure is. And indeed, just last week, they packed up and shipped the main big 8.4 primary mirror from Tucson. It's starting its trip to Houston, and it will arrive here in Chile in May sometime.
Oh, man.
That is so cool. Can you tell us a little bit about what makes an LSST, a Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, special or different?
Yeah, I get asked a lot, why can't we just do this kind of science with Hubble or one of the other telescopes that exists? So the unique thing about LSST is that it's a big mirror, it's 8.4 meters. It moves really quickly, and it has a huge field of view on the sky. So you can imagine covering 40 full moons within a single image. Whoa. So what the telescope does is it looks at one part of the sky, it takes a 30-second image, and then it moves and covers another part of the sky. And it has such a big field of view and moves so quickly that it covers the entire southern hemisphere sky every 3 nights. And wow. It does this every 3 nights over 10 years. So you can imagine we're going to collect the biggest time-lapse movie of the entire universe.
So in 3 days, 3 nights, you can gather all the information that everybody else has looked at for thousands of years.
Yeah, well, and no other telescope in the southern hemisphere can cover this amount of sky so quickly. So the data that it can generate is crazy. It's something like 20 terabytes a night.
Whoa.
My gosh.
And the other cool thing that it can do is every time it takes an image, it can subtract that from one of the previous images it took of that part of the sky. So it can, within a minute, tell you any object that has gotten brighter or fainter or exists now that didn't exist before or disappeared. And so once it finds those things, it'll send an alert out to the entire world to say, hey, look over here. And we're estimating we'll find about 10 million of those changing objects every single night.
Oh, man.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, this is going to keep all the astronomers are busy for a while. That's good job security with all those terabytes that are coming in.
Absolutely.
So Anne and I have been talking about the Southern Hemisphere a little bit. And so you were stationed in Australia for a while. What was it like? What was it like doing astronomy from Australia?
It was fascinating. Australia doesn't actually have very high mountains, which is what you would like for optical astronomy to get up out of the atmosphere. But it has the crystal clear view straight into the heart of our Milky Way galaxy. It's got the Large Magellanic Cloud and the Small Magellanic Cloud, which are these tiny galaxies that are orbiting around our own Milky Way. And it's got some of my favorite constellations. So even when the telescope's operating, I could kind of go outside and just enjoy the night sky view.
Oh, where was the observatory located? Were you in the outback, or were you kind of like in the center part of the country, or towards the coast?
I was towards the coast. It's about 7 hours north of Sydney on the east coast in a region called the Warrumbungles National Park, which is now the first dark sky park in all of Australia. So that's where the Anglo-Australian telescope was located that I was observing with.
Oh, that's fun. We're going to veer off a little. Did you like living in Australia? Were there a lot of spiders?
That was
really
the main question Anna really wants to ask about the wildlife.
I just know they have really big spiders, and it freaks me out. I'm sorry. did you like it, or was it a little too spidery?
It was spidery. I will say that.
Really
oh my
was.
God!
Was
I told you, Dean?
I thought I was making fun of her.
I know it was really okay. So go on with the spiders. Okay. Oh my gosh.
There's a spider called a huntsman spider, and at full length, it's about the size of your hand. And oh my God. We used to get them in one of the apartments that I lived in. There would be one that just kind of hung out for about a week. And
oh my God.
It would scare you when you would walk around the corner. But the good thing is that it ate roaches and it didn't harm humans at all. So if you could kind of get over that shock factor, they were good to have around.
That's a big if, Amanda. If you can get over the shock, you're just strolling around. There's something like the size of what's a bunny? What I mean, my God. Oh God. Okay, we're getting off track, but I knew it. I told you, Dean.
Yeah, I was
very
expecting
spidery.
Like out in the wild, but now in the apartment.
She said in her apartment.
I know, that makes me now I'm more terrified.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it was scary. I live in Tucson now, and the desert creatures in Tucson are nothing compared to what I saw in Australia.
Really?
Although they don't have kangaroos. And there was one very memorable night observing where you have to go out of the telescope and you walk across this little field to get to where our lodge was, where we slept and where I had my night lunch. And so I was, of course, going outside and looking straight up just at the stars, not paying attention, and accidentally bumped into a kangaroo.
As you're just strolling around.
Is that the most Australian thing you've ever heard? Like, I just bumped right into a kangaroo.
We both were completely shocked, and we both sort of bounced back. It looked at each other and very slowly moved away, and then off we went in our own direction.
That is hilarious.
The only thing you can add to that is, like, I dropped my boomerang and my Fosters. That's right. The only thing you can add to that to make it more Australian.
Oh my God.
Pretty great.
That is great.
Well, so the field of astronomy has taken you all around the world, and so now you're stationed in Tucson, and your main job is education and public outreach. How did that come about? And tell us a little about your journey to become an astronomer.
Yeah, so I was always pretty fascinated with the stars, and didn't think it was a thing anybody could do. I didn't know any scientists growing up, so it kind of surprised me when I was at the University of Cincinnati and could study physics with a focus in astronomy. And then I went on to get a PhD, and I went on to do a research postdoc in England. But it was during that time that it was the International Year of Astronomy in 2009, and I was just fascinated by trying to communicate these really complicated but fascinating concepts to people who weren't just other scientists. And so I practiced writing to the general public and my family based on my travels and these astronomy things through a blog called AstroPixie. This was the time that Twitter kind of started up, and there was a really interesting group of science communicators there. And it just kind of kept going. I started to get media training opportunities in Australia. I started to get contacts with the radio and journalism societies there. And then they actually offered me at the Australian Astronomical Observatory a position that was half research and half outreach officer. So that helped me begin to, for the first time, think strategically about what should our communication message be? What should our education focus be as an organization? And how do we maximize our message to the kind of people that we really want to engage with? And so from there, it kept going. It was pretty successful. I got to make some really fun videos and talk to people all over the country, both remotely through the internet and in person. And then that brought me to this head of education and public outreach for LSST, which now I have a team of people. I have an education specialist. I've got developers. I've got astronomers. So I've got a whole range of people who can really work together to create something new that hasn't existed before. And it's fascinating. It's challenging, but it's also fascinating what we're going to be able to do with this telescope's data as far as bringing it into the classroom and getting it in people's hands.
Well, and you're now able to show people a real scientist. So kids can meet you as the scientist and maybe get inspired.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a long journey to come here, but it's important to realize that it's not just trained scientists who make this happen. There are engineers, there are writers, there are almost any walk of life. People can come and contribute to the production of these telescopes and the understanding of this, of the universe.
Well, it's so cool that you've gotten to travel around so much and you're doing such cool work. And I know that you are a Cincinnati native, so we were just curious if there's anything you miss about Cincinnati, or that you kind of, you know, as you're on your cool travels everywhere.
Well, I will say Cincinnati chili. I'm a Skyline fan, so I always stop there every time I'm home.
Oh.
The Sydney New Year's Eve fireworks are pretty legendary, and I would say the only other fireworks I've seen that come close are the Labor Day fireworks in Cincinnati, so well done, Cincinnati. I miss that.
Yeah, but no kangaroos to bump into while you're looking at the fireworks. You're like, oh, they're just going to be here standing watching.
Just another Cincinnati just you bump into. We're a lot more rude, probably, than
That's
kangaroo.
Right.
Well, I was lucky. I didn't get boxed. I came out of that unscathed, amazingly.
That's not a myth. They really will kick you or punch you, the kangaroos?
They do. So I've seen little groups of kangaroos that live up on the mountain, and you get what looked to me like two males. They were some of the bigger ones in this group, and they kind of stand up on their hind legs, and they have these massive tails, which they use for balance, and they can get up on their tail and start hitting each other with those massive hind legs, and it's kind of terrifying.
Australia is terrifying.
Australia,
I know,
they've got some interesting things.
He never listens.
But it's absolutely beautiful. It's stunning. The people are very nice. I mean, it's, you have to put up with some of these little quirks in order to just see these beautiful views.
That's cool. That's nice.
Well,
I like that.
This has been so fun talking with you, Amanda. So, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great time in Chile, and we'll hopefully talk to you again soon. You're back in Tucson.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'll be happy to come back anytime.
Well, as we've learned working at the observatory, everyone has opinions, and some of them are wrong, sadly.
There's no better way to put
them's
it than
the
that.
Breaks.
That's right.
I don't know. This is what we like to feature one of these opinions or thoughts in our crank file. And Dean, why don't you take it away with this episode's crank file?
You remind me of like teachers, like whenever somebody would ask like a stupid question that's so far off, the teacher would be like, good question. They're
good
all
try.
Good questions. Well, this
the
one.
Only stupid question is the one you don't ask.
That's right.
Unless you think like the earth is flat. Or
that's
something.
What teachers always say. Yeah.
Right.
Well, so I got one that unfortunately made it to, well, print, I guess you would say. It was on the internet.
It must have been true.
And I'm going to call out the media source. It was a Vox article.
Oh, no.
And they were talking about the equinox and, you know, what happens on the.
All legal materials to Dean Regas.
And
Vox,
I will say that they have corrected it, but I did see it, and it's too late because I saw it. So
no take backs.
It's in my mind, and so I won't call out the.
We're moving forward.
Call out the author, but no, I won't call out the author. But the article was, it had a lot of great stuff about the equinox and about all this, but it gave one very common misconception. It said that when we head towards summer, it's summer because we're closer to the sun in summer.
That's wrong.
Very good. Good answer.
Yes.
That is way wrong. It's
way off.
And
it's embarrassing.
Author even doubled down by saying the Northern Hemisphere summer, that's when we're closer to the sun. That is wrong again. So, yes. It's the opposite. We are actually farther from the sun when the Northern Hemisphere has summer. We're farthest from the sun every year around July 4th. And we're closest to the sun every year around January 4th. Mm. Now, if that doesn't make any sense to you, that shouldn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't.
Because January is not usually hot and July is not usually cold. So,
although in Cincinnati, you never know.
That's true.
But you're right.
Know.
Not supposed to be.
You never know.
That's right.
So, but by and large, so the whole thing about seasons is all caused by the tilt of the earth. It's how we're tilted. So in the summertime for us in the Northern Hemisphere, we're tilted towards the sun. We are not closer to the sun, but the sunlight comes in at more direct angles. So we get more energy per square inch, and thus it's hotter. But we're actually slightly farther away from the sun during our summer.
Get right out of here.
That's right. Now, so this leads to a actual intelligent question that the author could have put forth, but didn't.
But I'm guessing didn't. Yeah.
No,
okay.
Because he got the first part wrong.
Oh,
but
no.
But if we're closer to the sun in January, and it's winter here,
right?
What's it in the Southern Hemisphere?
Summer.
Right. So is the Southern Hemisphere summer when we're closer to the sun hotter than our summer when we're farther from the sun? And the answer is?
Why don't you tell me? Just to make sure that you got it. I want to make sure I'm not giving you the answer.
Just a little bit. Not much, but just a little bit.
What?
Yes, because we're closer to the sun by about 2-3%. So we see about 2-3% difference. So summer hemisphere summer is slightly hotter in theory than the Northern Hemisphere summer.
This also debunks another crank file that I think we've talked about, though. That's like, you know, have you heard that like fact, quote, I'm using horns.
Right.
Fact that if we were like 1 inch closer to the sun, we would like incinerate. And if we were like 1 inch farther away, we would like freeze to death or whatever. I feel like this sort of addresses that one, too.
That's right, because we do vary our distance from the sun quite a bit. We're
take that, internet.
So on it's a difference of about 2 million miles, so not just an inch. Yeah, so we're about 2 million miles closer to the sun in January than we are in July.
It is more than an inch. Thank you for the clarification.
That is more than an inch. So thank you, Vox, for that. And we'll be looking forward to future articles.
Oh, you're going to be reading them closely.
Oh, I'm watching everybody, baby. Watch out.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Amanda Bauer for joining us. You'll find a link to the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
We really appreciate you listening and would love to hear from you. You can drop us a note with topic or guest ideas or questions about space on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at lookingup@wvxu.org.
Parents, we hope you'll share Looking Up with your kids and send us any questions they may have. Or if you have questions, we want to hear those too.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. If you're new to Looking Up, you can always find all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
Our theme song and additional music is by Why, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.